Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, is the TikTok trend of under-consumption core just minimalism on social media? And what's changed since the golden age of protest music? But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I've dealt with a lot of con artists in my life, and I put Donald Trump in that. He, you know, talks a great game, but he really doesn't carry through, and I'm not sure that, you know, he's really out for the best interests of those in our country over his own advantages that he creates for himself.
I think we need to stand up for safeguarding our elections, and so we'll see what comes out of this.
You kind of just see a close race where the overall registration edge that Republicans have in Arizona makes it just barely tilt red, but really so close that either campaign could win it.
Would have been the wrong thing. Would have been a political disaster for the Republicans, but more importantly, would have been hurtful for the American people.
This is not providing any process improvement or discernible benefit. It simply grinds the program down and makes life more difficult for both parents and the administration of the program.
I, like many in this community, was alarmed to read the accusations from the DOJ of racial disparities in our policing. This finding is unacceptable. So we will take the necessary steps to ensure every community member is treated with dignity and respect.
And with me to talk about VP Kamala Harris's trip to the border, Governor Hobbs getting a chance to name a state Supreme Court justice and more, are Matthew Benson of the firm Veritas. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman. Aaron, good morning to you.
Happy to be here.
So immigration, Aaron, has been kind of a liability for Vice President Kamala Harris as she's running for president now. Is it possible to make a dent in that by visiting Douglas?
Well, I just wonder what Republicans are going to talk about once she's gone to the border, because that's been the biggest talking point is, you know, where's she been? What's she doing? I think she has a really good answer on this, which is, you know, they tried to get something done politically. It would have actually solved the problem. And as she says, President Trump wanted to run on a problem, not actually have a solution. I think it's a fair point. What took so long? Clearly, the executive order has had a massive impact. You know, the illegal crossings are way down. Should it have come sooner? I think absolutely. But I think she's at least kind of fighting to a draw. What's really happened on the immigration thing, honestly, is the Democrats have largely adopted the Republican position. Both parties, if you look at what they're talking about, are really for pro-strengthening borders. Democrats actually want to get something done. And it seems like from the presidential politics perspective, Trump just wants to keep talking about it to keep it alive as an issue.
Matt, safe to say Republicans will find something to talk about on immigration, even if Harris is at the border?
Oh, there's no doubt. I think it's a mistake for Harris to be out here going to the border. I think every minute she spends talking about illegal immigration and border security is a lost opportunity for her, because the record that the Biden and Harris administration have on this issue is so abysmal. And Donald Trump he'd love to have the focus of this campaign in the final 40 days be on the border. And so I just think Kamala Harris is talking about an issue that's a loser for her in a state that she is unlikely to win. And so I think it's a mistake for her.
Is there something to be said? We hear a lot about, especially recently, candidates going to places where they know they're not going to win, but maybe try to lose by less. Is this an effort, maybe a worthwhile effort or not a worthwhile effort, to try to at least sort of stem the tide a little bit for Harris?
Look, I mean, illegal immigration has been her weakest issue. And so if we were having this conversation 2 months ago, weeks and weeks and weeks ago, fine, I could understand it. But at this point, after not visiting the border for so long, now at the last minute to go do a photo op in Douglas, I just think it comes across craven and politically opportunistic. And I don't think voters are going to buy it.
She's taking a page out of Trump's playbook. Look, in my neighborhood, Paradise Valley, there's a lot of Republicans for Harris signs going up. And the reality is that's who kind of decides our statewide elections. Those independents, those I call them quite literally, and they got me elected to the legislature, country club Republicans, fiscally conservative, socially more moderate. I think they want to feel like Harris cares about this issue. It's super important on the Republican side. We see that polling again and again and again. I think she tries to check the box and kind of get over that and neutralize it a little bit. Some of the polling numbers on the economy, she's come way back. It's been really interesting to see. She's kind of got that to an even. And then you're kind of left with the personality stuff. And, you know, most people don't like Donald Trump's personality. They feel like he's kind of a crazy, weird guy. And if she can neutralize the things where he's had this natural advantage and then make it be about Donald Trump and how kind of crazy he is, I think that's a winning hand. And I hope she'll squeak by just like President Biden did here in Arizona.
But Aaron, to Matt's point, like doing this now with what, 5 or 6 weeks left until the election, does that do anything? Does it even check the box? I mean, is it like, is this an opportunity, a missed opportunity, as Matt was saying, maybe to talk about issues that she's stronger on where she might not get a lot of bang for the buck going to the border at this point?
Look, politics is about, you know, showing up and getting your picture taken and showing people what issues you care about by where you're spending your time. She's showing that she cares about it. I do think, I mean, this is, I just laugh because was it politically craven when Trump was at the border last week? You know what I mean? Like, everyone's trying to do the same thing. And the reality of the situation is I think she's trying to get it to closer to neutral, to your point, and then give people permission to vote for her. My wife, who is not super into politics, I will say, has a theory that where people used to on the polls underreport their Trump vote, that we might be heading towards an underreported Harris vote, where there's a lot of people who just don't like Trump enough but don't totally feel comfortable voting for Harris. If this gets them over that hurdle, it could be the difference in her winning Arizona.
Hmm. All right. So, Matt, Aaron kind of alluded to polls, and we've kind of seen them all over the place. We obviously know polls are a snapshot in time, and depending on how the questions are asked and who's doing it and number of voters, margin of error, all of those are variables. But I'm curious what you make at this point, almost the beginning of October. We've seen polls that show former President Trump up by 5. We've seen polls that show Vice President Harris up by a couple. Like, what do you make of sort of these polls being all over the place on the presidential level?
Well, in terms of Arizona, I think the general consensus, if you average these things out, is that Trump is ahead by a few points in Arizona. There was a poll out today that said he's up 5. I don't know whether that's accurate, but I do suspect he is up by a few. And I think that is bolstered by looking at the other polls and seeing where he has made up ground against the Democrats, particularly among Hispanic voters and Hispanic men. And that is a big problem in the Sun Belt for Kamala Harris. So I would suspect that Trump is in the pole position here.
Aaron, do you agree? If you had to be one of these candidates in Arizona right now, is it better to be Trump?
Just to be clear, I couldn't spend a minute inside the skin of Donald Trump, so I'm always going to say Harris in that one. But I think the reality is this is a lean right state, and a more moderate, pragmatic Republican would win the state going away. That's not who Donald Trump is. And it's those kind of chaotic personality issues, zigzagging. By the way, he's also really old. I mean, I don't know if anyone's, you know, kept up. Bill Clinton, I think, is 2 years younger than him. He was elected president 30 years ago. I think a lot of that's starting to show, and that's what's putting the state in play, quite honestly. You know, Biden eked it out by the narrowest of margins, and I think Harris has a chance. Harris has actually been running, from an economic perspective, a much more conservative campaign than Biden was. She's not talking about wealth taxes and all those other things. She's talking about a tax cut for 100 million Americans. She's talking about, I think there was a whole thing on starting small businesses and tax credits. She's actually playing more of that centrist economic music right now than Joe Biden was, for whatever reason. It's kind of been interesting to see. To the extent to which anybody follows that and gets into that minutia is a whole nother question, but I think she definitely has a chance.
All right. So, Matt, we talked about the polls for president kind of all over the place. Polls in the U.S. Senate race are less all over the place. Most, if not all of them, have shown that Ruben Gallego has at least a lead, oftentimes outside the margin of error, although not always. Do you see this race maybe a little less unpredictable at this point?
Yeah, 100%. I think that the polling suggests that Ruben Gallego is up at least 5 points. And I won't be surprised if he wins by 6 to 8. So, I mean, you know, if Trump wins Arizona by a handful of points, it seems hard to believe that he would outperform Kerry Lake by that much. But, man, people seem to have really made up their minds about her after this campaign and the previous campaign for governor. I just don't think there are that many undecided voters when it comes to Kerry Lake. And she has just bled a lot of support among the, you know, the old McCain voters, of which there are many.
Yeah.
And so that is really hurting her. And And Ruben Gallego has run a smart campaign. He's a combat Marine, and he is outspending her and outraising her about 3+1. So that's a huge problem if you're Kerry Lake.
Do you think that Kerry Lake, I mean, obviously, once the campaign is over, there'll be a lot of time to talk about who did what right and wrong. But I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of talk several months ago about Kerry Lake figuring that she would have a lot of outside money to help supplement what she was able to raise. And as some of those polls came in and showed Gallego with consistent leads, it seems like some of that money maybe didn't come through to the extent she thought it would. And I wonder if maybe she was a little too reliant, or her campaign has become a little too reliant on outside money as opposed to money it is bringing in.
I think it's incumbent on every candidate to prove their viability. And she wasn't able to do that. And the cascade of polls showing her down anywhere from 5, 10, 13 points, you know, the Republicans nationally are trying to find out where's the best bang for our buck, and it's been in these other states.
That money is ruthless. I mean, they look at a poll and say, okay, they're making choices around where to invest and where not to invest. And she's clearly on the wrong side of that. I personally just desperately hope she continues running for elective office in Arizona. I think she'd be great for governor for next year. She's fantastic at winning Republican.
Don't speak that into the universe.
Carrie, just keep going. Three's a charm. She's great at winning Republican primaries and really struggles in the main election. It hasn't been a great fundraiser either, but it just gets to people are making really cold calculations. We're seeing that on the other side now. There's an incredible amount of money flooding in here for Amit Shah, for example, because he's right in it, like, you know, could beat Schweiker for the first time. And we're seeing millions and millions of dollars of ad buys by those same folks who are looking and saying, where can we make the biggest difference? That money's coming from another market where, so, you know, someone's further behind and they're triaging and putting the chips where they think they can win.
Aaron, do you agree with Matt's assessment that the race for Senate seems to be, at least at this point, Gallego's to lose?
Yeah, for sure. I think Congressman Gallego has run a great race, to Matt's point. He's really leaned into his biography on as a veteran, which he really deserves. I mean, he's run a very, very smart race, and he's running against a candidate who just can't get out of her own way in terms of getting to the middle. And I think that combination of things has been has been great for Congressman Gallego, and I think he'll be a fantastic senator for Arizonans.
All right, that is Aaron Lieberman. I'm also joined by Matthew Benson. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. My Friday Newscap guest this week, former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman and Matthew Benson of Veritas. Matt, let me start with you. The Supreme Court Justice Robert Brutinel says that he is going to be retiring before the mandatory retirement age. He'll be stepping down later this fall, which gives Governor Katie Hobbs a chance to appoint somebody to the state Supreme Court. And this is the first time that a Democratic governor appointed justice will be on the court in a number of years.
Yeah, I mean, you go back to Janet Napolitano, right? So that's a long time ago since the Democrats have made an appointment to the high court. So I think that'll be fascinating. This happens against the backdrop of a couple justices, in particular, Bolick and King, mm-hmm. that are the subject of this, you know, high profile effort to get them not retained and a ballot measure out there separately. So yeah, I mean, potentially you could see multiple Supreme Court picks coming the governor's way.
Aaron, how big of a deal is this for Governor Hobbs to be able to nominate somebody to the court? I mean, it's obviously not going to change the balance of power in terms of conservative thinking versus more liberal thinking, but seems like a fairly significant thing.
It's huge, you know, and it's been a long time coming for sure. It'll be interesting to see if she gets some more, because that's when you can really start to get things in the middle, when you have some of those justices who might be open and you've got two or three votes who are willing to look at things a little bit differently. I'm laughing because I've seen so many of those signs that say keep politics out of the judiciary, like, you know, in the retention of Bolick and King. And it's kind of politics that got them into this mess in the beginning. So it'll be really interesting to see. I haven't seen polling. I don't even know how you could poll on those judicial retention numbers. It'd be really tough to find out. But it all gets back to the issue of choice and the decisions that the Supreme Court made, which is what has put those justices on the front lines of this. It's not quite a recall effort. It's complicated to say a non-retention effort.
Right.
But it's gotten way more attention than anyone that I've seen in the time I've been following Arizona politics.
Aaron, if you were advising Governor Hobbs, what would you tell her to look for in a prospective Supreme Court justice?
You know, people might be surprised to hear me say I really appreciate John Roberts in this one regard, but he made that incredible quote of saying our job is to call balls and strikes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think you look for. Someone who's actually going to look at the Constitution of Arizona and not be guided by their own political view. And frankly, I think that will move us much more to the middle than where we've been, where we've seen things. I mean, honestly, in the case of Bullock, an ideologue, the head of the Goldwater Institute, it's very, very clear he had an agenda. And I think one of our currently serving members of the judiciary in state courts and other things like that would be a great pick for something like this. So it's getting it out of the realms of politics and getting into the realms of you know, making good judicial decisions.
Matt, what are those conversations like in a governor's office? I mean, you worked for Governor Brewer for a number of years. What are those conversations like when you're trying to figure out who is the right person to put on the bench?
It's an extensive vetting process. And typically you're looking at people who have already served at various levels of the judiciary system. So they've been vetted, but being vetted for the Supreme Court is a different level. And so they're looking at everything, just trying to make sure that this is somebody who's going to pass muster, who is going to be where you think they are politically. And you know, the other thing is, like, I think you want to make sure it's somebody who's built to be in that position for the long haul.
So I wanted to ask you about, like, is how big of a consideration is age in this?
It's a big consideration.
Because you want them there for decades, right?
When you asked Aaron what he would be looking for in an appointment for the Supreme Court, I was thinking youth. Because you want somebody who's going to be in that role for a long time.
And, right.
You know, Katie Hobbs, Governor Hobbs getting one appointment to the court isn't going to make a big difference in the court's direction. She has to have a full two terms in order to really put her stamp on that court. And so that's going to be the question.
Do either of you, Aaron mentioned that, like, getting polling on the retention or non-retention is really, really difficult. Do either of you have a gut feeling about how that's going to go? Like, if either of those justices will be not retained or not? Aaron, do you have a sense on that?
It gets to how much it can break through. I mean, we've seen the polling numbers on the pro-choice ballot initiative. It's overwhelmingly supported by a majority of Arizonans. And if people connect King and Bullock to the anti-choice side of that, which is really what has stirred up a lot of this, I think they could lose. The ballot is going to be like a small book this year with all of the ballot initiatives. And, you know, there was drop off in our state representative races. We were trying to get people to pay attention down that way. By the time you get to judges, it's really hard. So it kind of gets to who has that passion, who has that motivation. And we'll see if, you know, the pro-choice folks like myself are able to connect that and crash through to get people to vote not to retain them.
Do you have a gut feeling on this one, Matt?
I don't, but I 100% agree with Aaron that the question is whether Democrats are successful in connecting the abortion initiative support and getting those same voters to not retain Bullock and King and Republicans to just sort of leave that whole section blank. That's going to be the calculus.
Sure. So, Aaron, you mentioned that the Abortion Access Initiative has support in Arizona. There was a New York Times Siena College poll this week that found 58% support for Prop 139. I'm wondering, like, is that, given where we are in the cycle and given potential drop-off as we get toward the bottom of the ballot, is that high enough to make the supporters of this comfortable?
I think so. I mean, that's a pretty good number, honestly, for these types of initiatives going in at this point. I would be shocked if we wake up and we don't have a constitutionally protected right for a woman to make her own healthcare choices around abortion here in Arizona.
Matt, do you think that's high enough?
Well, you only have to win by one.
You 50% plus one. That's,
you know,
true.
I think that is one of the few issues on election night that we're going to know very early the result. We may know the result with that first drop of ballots. I suspect that it's going to win somewhere in that 60-40, 65-35 range.
Okay. Guys, there have been a lot of debates going on as we get closer to early ballots going out. And one of the ones that we saw this week was for Maricopa County Sheriff, which in the past has been a very high-profile election, especially when Joe Arpaio was running. slightly less so now with all of the other sort of big races and initiatives that we've talked about taking up some of the oxygen. But Matt, I'm curious what you made of this race between Jerry Sheridan and Camp here, because it seems like it's almost less about what they want to do and more about, at least based on the debates, more about who they are and what they have done in their past.
Oh, no, 100%. And they both have so much baggage. So, I mean, it's really fascinating. I mean, you've got Sheridan and his connection with Arpaio and the lawsuits and the racial profiling and all of that. And then you've got the Democrat and they, you know, with the after they left office, the accusations about sexually harassing, you know, a subordinate and the text messages and all of that. And they've only been a Democrat for like 5 minutes, right? They were a Republican previously. So it's quite a circus.
Is this the kind of, I mean, you mentioned people, you know, Kamala Harris trying to make the presidential race about who Donald Trump is. It seems like both of these sheriff's candidates are trying to do the same thing about their opponent.
Yeah. And you know, and it's really tough in races like this that don't get that much attention. You know what I mean? You got to have a lot of money to communicate, to be able to do the paid communication and everything else to make people understand these personality issues. It'll be interesting to see. You know, I thought we just had a fantastic sheriff for the last, you know, few years, who was kind of right where you need to be as a Democrat to win this race, a very middle of the road guy in Paul Penzone. It'll be interesting to see kind of what happens here. I agree with you. For whatever reason, it doesn't feel like the stakes are so high like it used to with crazy Joe Arpaio.
Well, why do you think that is? Because, I mean, I've heard some Democrats saying, like, if you vote for the Republican, you're basically putting Arpaio back in office, which would seem to, you would think it would maybe start some alarm bells going off among Democrats.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem to have broken through. And I think, frankly, most people are worried about the crazy guy at the top of the ticket now, and it's taken a lot of the oxygen in the room. And, you know, truthfully, you know, people forget the Arpaio craziness was starting to be a long time ago. I think it was 2018, I believe, when Penzone won, I think for the first time, maybe 2016.
I think it was 2016. Yeah, maybe because Arpaio lost when Trump won.
I think. And you know, somewhere I believe Joe Arpaio will continue running for mayor of Fountain Hills or whatever he's up to these days. But that's a long time in politics. I mean, we're getting, you know, eight years away. So I think some of that craziness has kind of faded away.
What do you think about that, Matt? I mean, do you think people in Maricopa County have forgotten what Arpaio was as sheriff?
I don't know if they've forgotten, but you're right. It is an eternity ago. And so I think people are focused on other things. There's higher profile races, and it's very difficult to break through when you're talking about races for president and Senate and all these, you know, very close congressional swing races. All of the ballot measures, this race for a county office is kind of playing second fiddle.
All right, Aaron, we got about 45 seconds left. You are dressed in Diamondbacks colors today.
Go D-backs. It's a huge, huge – we should sell out Chase Field tonight as watching the D-backs try to get into the playoffs.
Do they make the playoffs?
I think they make the playoffs. It may take a Braves loss on the doubleheader on Monday to make it happen.
Matt, I won't ask you about the Rockies. I'm sorry.
They're not going to make the playoffs.
They're not going to – maybe get them next year. D-backs, playoffs, what do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, fair enough. Matthew Benson, Aaron Lieberman, thanks so much for the conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Go D-backs.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a look into how protest music has changed since the late 60s. But first, although many social media platforms started as places to share photos and keep up with friends, an overwhelming number of them have leaned into something else, shopping. Whether it's an in-store, in-app store, or paid partnerships with influencers, people who use TikTok especially are under a lot of pressure to buy. But recently, lots of users have been making videos touting something called under-consumption core, basically an effort to buy fewer things and use all of the things people do have. Tiffany Ferguson makes YouTube videos under the series Internet Analysis and recently broke down the concept of underconsumption core. I spoke with her earlier and asked what got her thinking about this.
As always, a lot of my topics lately are led by the TikTok algorithm. So myself, like many people, was just delivered, you know, these videos all of a sudden. And of course, it piqued my interest as a viewer. I definitely do consume a lot of sustainability, you know, leaning kind of content. And I like to see anything that criticizes overconsumption. So I'm a good target audience for that kind of a topic. And then very quickly, like, I'm also a big reader of comment sections. So as I saw the discourse forming, I said, okay, this is definitely going to be a good topic to cover on my channel.
So how do you describe under consumption core? And I wonder if that is similar or dissimilar to how others online would describe it.
I would describe it as under consumption is the idea of consuming maybe less than the average. So, you know, you're reusing things, you're making use of older items. But under consumption core is specifically about romanticizing that idea. It's about the aesthetic of, you know, being a little more eco-friendly, consuming less, essentially just making use of what you have and trying not to overconsume.
And does it seem like that's sort of the general consensus? I mean, I know the internet is, you know, traditionally a place where people tend to agree and have very reasonable thoughts about things.
Well, that's what I found so interesting when I started to try to analyze this trend was just the term under consumption core to me just does not make sense. because it's like, what is your frame of reference? Under consuming says who? Like, compared to what? And so that was where a lot of the interesting conversations came from, is people online arguing about, no, that doesn't count as under consumption. That's normal, or that's even above average still, where other people are like, no, that to me looks like poverty. So I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I guess it's tough to define under or over when you don't have a common baseline.
Right, exactly.
So what kinds of things are people online talking about? Maybe they're trying to reuse more, or maybe not, you know, not buy as much of, or, you know, use every last drop kind of thing?
Yeah, from what I saw, there was kind of the classics like reusing mason jars and drinking out of them, which is like one of the strongest just like visual signals of sustainability, I feel like. Like in the past like decade, it's been like, if you're reusing your mason jars, that's a sign. If you're drinking from regular cups, you're just being wasteful. which is hilarious. But no, there's other things like, yeah, some users talked about having a much smaller daily makeup routine or skincare, and just pointing to like a handful of products that they use every day, which to me, I'm like, yeah, same. That seems very reasonable. But again, it's you always have to remind yourself, especially watching this on TikTok, that it's in opposition to the crazy overconsumption that we've seen. And that's where we've seen like literally drawers and drawers, or even a closet full of makeup and skincare products that, of course, one person could never ever use.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, like, how is this different from people who have tried to, you know, use less? I mean, this using less and, you know, to an extent, minimalism is not a new concept. Like, people have been doing this for many, many years. Is this different?
Exactly. And that's fascinating as well. I think that lends itself to the TikTokification of everything, to use a term that's very popular on TikTok. Everything is a ification now. But yeah, like there always has to be a name, a new label for something. So it's an era, it's a core, it's a blank aesthetic. but that's the thing, is like the underlying themes of underconsumption are very familiar and very similar to, you know, what we've seen in other sustainability-led movements or in minimalism, or, you know, there's been decluttering or de-influencing. But it's slightly different because of that focus on, like, instead of prior movements that were like, for example, minimalism, telling you to like declutter, get rid of all your junk, have a much lighter life, under consumption core is more like, you don't have to get rid of everything you own. If anything, just use it.
For the people who are making these TikToks, is there, like, what's the end here? Like, you mentioned, you know, decluttering to, you know, live a lighter life and, you know, maybe enjoy your space a little bit more. Like, to what end are people advocating under consumption core?
I think under consumption core is just more about practicing a mindset shift. That's the way that I've definitely internalized it, is like the practice of looking around at your house, appreciating little items like, wow, I've had my coffee machine for a good 5 years and I don't need to get a new one because this one still works. Or, wow, I appreciate those hand-me-downs from my family, or that secondhand jacket that I've had for a decade. How wonderful. Like, I think it really is, yeah, more of like a daily practice to integrate the romanticizing of appreciating your own stuff, but also, like, again, the practicality of being like, next time I feel tempted to go buy, you know, a new coffee machine, being like, no, I have a perfectly nice functional one and I'm going to use it until it either breaks or, you know, I can't get it fixed. And yeah, it's like more of like a mantra to repeat to yourself every time you're going to shop for something new.
One thing that you also talk about is sort of the class dynamics at play here, where, you know, for some people, they might look at this as a choice they get to make about how much they buy, how much they consume. But for other people, it's really just kind of a necessity, just kind of a reality of their lives.
Exactly. And I think these are similar critiques that were, you know, also pointed at, like minimalism, for example, is like, yes, for a middle class or upper class wealthy person, the idea of buying less or living a simpler life is seen as like trendy and aspirational. But again, for somebody who is poor or broke, it's not a choice. It's not romantic. It's not cute. And so that's always something, I think, at the very least, to be aware of. You would hope that people would have some class consciousness when they're making this kind of content. But it's also interesting because I've seen comments from people who say their experience as a lower income person can be the opposite, where it's like, you can't be a minimalist because you actually need to keep everything, because you actually might need things and you might, you know, not be able to afford to replace them.
All right. That is Tiffany Ferguson. She makes YouTube videos under the series Internet Analysis. Tiffany, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As part of our Last Resort series, we thought it would be fun to see what architectural elements from Phoenix's iconic resort past still exist.
From all over the world, come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix. A simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
Today's hidden gem is the Jokaki Inn's bell tower. The Pueblo Revival-style building is all that remains of the once legendary Jokaki Inn, which got its start in the 1920s as a tea room. The show's Sativa Peterson met up with Scott Jarson, a longtime realtor in town who specializes in architecturally unique homes. The two walked around the structure as he explained what makes the building so exceptional.
So I have a lifelong interest in unique pieces of architecture and design that are left in the valley, and we're at one of the best of them. This is what's left of the historic Jokaki Inn. This is the bell tower, and it's a beautiful adobe structure. It dates from 1936. It was an absolute beacon in the desert that drew people to this resort. It really speaks to why people came here and their first introduction to Arizona and the Sonoran Desert. And if you can imagine the sense of awe of the unique beauty we had here that these visitors got to enjoy. Camelback as a beautiful backdrop and this soaring multi-level adobe structure, it had to be just a point of arrival as you came to start your winter vacation in Arizona. The architect of this was R.T. Evans. He was just known for doing these beautiful Pueblo Revival structures. He did probably 20, 30 structures up and down Camelback. His mother owned this property, and his mother was Jessie Benton Evans. She was an artist, and so you get these artists and architects with these desert dreams, and they realize them. She worked with Mary Coulter at Santa Fe Railroad and Fred Harvey Resorts. So there was that connection. She'd seen this. She understood what it was like to have these destination resorts, and her son realized it in the architecture. This bell tower structure was really important because it anchored this visually for miles. I mean, it was a very ambitious structure. And this is where they would hold tea in the afternoon. It was multi-purpose use. So this became the Jukaki Inn, the symbol for it. It's actually quite modern. So built in the 1930s, it had a conventional foundation. It had good quality windows. But it's multi-level, which is hard to do with adobe. Evans was a master of it. It was locally built. George Ellis was the general contractor. He has rich family ties and built for people like Frank Lloyd Wright. Originally, there were lower adobe structures to the east of the property. They were more like guest casitas. That was the initial start of the inn. There was the Jukaki School for Girls on property. So if you can imagine, this is a place where you might winter and then also have your children educated at the same time. This was a complete destination resort, unlike anything we see today. So at the time, this was probably, well, it was the largest building that you could find in and around Scottsdale. It had to be visible from downtown Scottsdale when the tree canopy was low and the people built lower. So it was so integrated. And if you can imagine Camelback Road, when Camelback was two words, and it's a two-lane road, mostly dirt, and you're coming from the train station in downtown Phoenix all the way out here in the desert. By the time you got out here, you saw this beacon of this tower and went, wow, phew. You would have had Arcadia to the south, all irrigated citrus groves. If you're here in the spring, it's heaven against this desert backdrop. So very special places, and they just spoke of Arizona, the climate and the space. The Jukaki Inn was such a signature detailed building. Evans really understand the nature of these Pueblo structures and how to control how he ornamented them so they weren't over the top. They were very subtle, but it still stands today. We're grateful for it.
That was Scott Jarson, realtor and founder of the real estate firm Jarson & Jarson. Today, the Jukaki Inn Bell Tower stands just inside the grounds of the Phoenician, still beckoning visitors. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. As a summer of political chaos draws to a close, the wars and policy debates that have prompted violence and upheaval remain. Some pundits are saying it feels like the late 60s all over again. But when it comes to music, things don't quite sound the same. Jason Woodbury has been documenting the fluctuations of the music industry for years on his podcast, Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. As he recently told the show's Sam Dingman, things have changed since the golden age of the protest anthem.
The late 60s, early 70s really are the time when a number of factors, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, produced a sort of cultural consciousness that crossed over into the pop realm. You've got songs like Creedence Clearwater Revival's Fortunate Son, an anti-war song that hit number 14 on the Billboard Hot 100. Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue. And when the band plays Hail to the Chief, ooh, they point the cannon at you. No, it ain't me. Also in 1969, John Lennon's Give Peace a Chance. Pretty blatant, outright lyric there. That also hit number 14. Not only is this stuff really conveying a point of view and a message, but it's also achieving mainstream success.
I think one of the interesting phenomena about the success of these songs is that it makes us look back at that time kind of through the lens of the popularity of the songs, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Like, because of the widespread resonance of those songs, it becomes very easy to look back at that time and think like, well, everybody hated the Vietnam War, when, of course, the reality is that those things were the subject of very intense debate.
Yeah. I almost feel like the pop culture element of it allows for a sort of retro fitting, right? Like oh yeah, everybody must have been on board because, I mean, listen to how good this song is. It's easier to paint a slightly rosier picture, maybe, if you're just going by the sort of artistic breakouts of that time.
Yeah. Well, and I'm curious to know what you think about this idea, too, that maybe another reason that it's easier to paint with a bit of a broad brush in terms of memory using these songs is that they were, by and large, channeling a kind of sentiment rather than a specific message against one particular party. You know, obviously there was probably, you know, some implicit messaging against, say, the Nixon administration, but it's not like it seemed like it was more about channeling a general spirit amongst the people rather than taking a firm stance on one side of the aisle or the other.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting to think about. You know, I think about the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song, Ohio, which was written about the Kent State massacre. And it specifically says, you know, tin soldiers and Nixon's coming. But I think it's that next line that almost speaks to what you're saying. You know, he says, we're finally on our own. That speaks a lot more to the spirit of a thing and sort of a general feeling than actually saying, you know, you can only listen to this song if you're against the Vietnam War. In the 80s and 90s, you get into stuff that actually probably was far more aligned with the actual very, very radical stuff from that counterculture. Stuff like Public Enemy, NWA. Police coming straight from the underground. A young got it bad because I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. That's because I ain't the one. These were artists that were speaking about very bleak realities and often accompanying them with really controversial statements, you know? And that remains popular music. When you think about news anchors freaking out over NWA lyrics, it's like a reminder that, like, that's the mainstream paying attention to this stuff. And I think that that continues on for a while. You know, in the early 2000s, you also had stuff like Green Day with American Idiot or the Dixie Chicks, now just the Chicks, but at the time the Dixie Chicks, who spoke out against the war in Iraq.
I thought I'd say something brand new and just say, just so you know, we're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas.
And really faced like a very, very intense backlash from the Nashville establishment.
We're gonna boycott them for their music and we're gonna boycott you for playing it if you don't stop playing it.
Well, ma'am, that was the last one you're gonna hear.
And I think that after that point, say in the early 2000s, you really do start to see the kind of popular protest song not completely go away, but certainly lessen in frequency.
Yeah, but I think it is really interesting that point you're making about the Chicks. I mean, obviously, the Chicks still have their fans, but at the time that they made that statement, they were one of the biggest acts in popular music, right?
That's right. And I mean, I think that when you even think about just sort of the strange way that political ideology ebbs and flows in relation to culture, you look at the Chicks who were taking this stance and were speaking out against the George Bush administration and people like Dick Cheney. You think about that in context of 2024, and you've got like Dick Cheney saying that you should vote for Kamala Harris, you know, the quote unquote progressive person on the ticket. And I think that speaks to just how weird and sort of complicated these things have become and how it's become increasingly difficult to sort of take a coherent stance in certain ways. And to some degree or another, most protest music requires that kind of specificity that's become maybe a little bit more elusive in a time where people are like, well, hang on, what exactly, where do I align? You know, is there an anti-war, you know, candidate or whatever, things like that. When you look at some of the stuff that has broken through in more recent time, there's a MAGA rapper, Foggiato Blow, who managed to score a really big hit with his song Boycott Target. Why they got pride shirts in the kids' clothing section? Why they trying to mess with the kids and give misconceptions? They manipulating minds and making evil impressions. That, Oliver Anthony's super viral Richmond, North of Richmond, which debuted at number one. Which politicians
Look out for miners, and not just miners on an island somewhere. Lord, we got folks in the street, ain't got nothing to heat, and the obese milk and welfare. Well, God, if you're 5 foot three and you're 300 pounds, taxes ought not to pay for your bags of fudge rounds. Young men are putting themselves.
Like, now you might actually have more of a chance of scoring like a protest hit if you're sort of saying something very different than what you might hear more progressive artists saying. And those are both examples, I think, that sort of show how this has changed quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, it certainly feels like we've come a long way from give peace a chance.
I mean, I like that one still. I'm a John and Yoko stan, so plenty of protest music in their canon to return to.
All right. Well, he is a John and Yoko stan, and he is also the host of the Aquarium Drunkards Transmissions podcast and a musician in his own right, Jason Woodbury. Thank you so much.
Thanks for hanging out, Sam. It's always great to talk.
People say we got it made. Don't they know we're so afraid? Isolation.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.